Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Well, I mean, overall, it didn't work out very well. I thought he came out of the chute with real good stuff when we gave up the four. You know, he threw a lot of pitches in the inning, and I thought he was starting to go to his breakable too much. And it looked to me like they started to hunt it, like they knew he was going to throw it. And he left a couple up, and those are the ones that hurt him. The whole night, we made it hard on ourselves to win. Kept trying, but we kept shooting ourselves in the foot. What we ultimately care about is when it's over, we're one run better than them, however we do it. Yeah, it's hard to imagine giving it to somebody better. You know, we tried to set up for a five-game series with plans, contingency plans. You know, we go to game five, we're at home, and we have Kluber. We're looking forward to it.
I thought my stuff was better than game one tonight. Velo was up. Curveball had more depth to it, I thought. I located pretty well. A couple little things went their way instead of mine. I think just as a team, we didn't play the greatest defense tonight, too. You know, little things in baseball games that beat you in the playoffs, you know.
We're still confident. You know, we believe in what we have. We believe that we're capable of doing. That was a good thing of winning the first two games, that we still got a chance. Can't be perfect every day. You hope and you practice and you work as hard as you can to try to be perfect. It's part of the game, you know. Sometimes you're gonna make mistakes, and you just gotta find a way to minimize them.
We didn't play, you know, good defense. I believe in this team. Corey Kluber on the mound on Wednesday. I think I like our chances.
One of the biggest plus marks for our team is our defense. I mean, it happened. It's baseball. Things like that happen. It's time to move on. Got to put it in the rearview mirror, and I feel like we're still in the driver's seat going home to play Game Five. The regular season doesn't really matter, but we earned the right to play Game 5 at home, and that's something that we're going to embrace. It's a good team over there. We didn't think we were just going to be able to throw our gloves on the field, and they beat us tonight.
You know, they kind of clawed their way back into it. You know, they got it to 5-3, but we were able to add on, and that's really important against a club like this, that we were able to change the momentum back. The fact that we've been able to play in some of these games, I think, helped. You play in the game Minnesota, you play in a game where you're down 2-0, you're down 2-1, you're facing a guy that we really didn't do anything the last time. I mean, obviously, we know we're facing a great pitcher, but there's a lot of confidence in that room, and they pick each other up, and they grind out at bats, and pitchers pick each other up, make big pitches. Should be a lot of fun Wednesday.
I think the Indians are in real trouble. We focus so much on Girardi and that decision. I don't think there's been enough talk about how much the Indians really miss Edwin Encarnacion in the middle of their lineup. They're hoping that he pulls a Willis Reed, overcomes this injury, and plays in Game 5, because I think it's had a lot of ripple effects. I think Jose Ramirez, who's so great during the regular season, is putting a ton of pressure on himself. Certainly looks like Andrew Miller's not close to being what he was last year. You know, there's some whispers, some something among the evaluators following this series that maybe Corey Kluber's hurt. Part of the reason why the Yankees chose Sabathia for Game 5 is the fact that Encarnacion is not in the Cleveland lineup.
There's one thing to do in action. There's another thing to make sure it can stand up under scrutiny of courts, under scrutiny of the league. And right now, there's nothing that permits them to be able to have that bright line rule that lets them say, hey, you can make a rule, sit a guy down, take his money. So that's where the fight's going to be. And even if the fight goes all the way to the NFL and goes through arbitration, as you know how that works, and if the NFL sides with Jerry Jones, you better believe it's a federal court fight. And there's a lot of other arguments that could come in that players could make to say, this is not fair. They could try to say that the rule is overbroad, that it's not defined clearly, and try to get the federal courts involved. So there's a difference between can you do it? I think he can do it. But can he enforce it and keep it and hold that rule in place? That's going to be a tough one. I think he can do it because this is a private agreement and it's not a public situation. So you talk about people say, well, you're limiting people's First Amendment rights. Kind of the old adage of, hey, you can say whatever you want, but you don't have a First Amendment right to a job.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Well, I tell you what, ESPN legal analyst Ryan Smith said a mouthful with that last part. For anybody and everybody trying to simplify the NFL's protest problem, the national anthem issue, simplifying it down to First Amendment, Trump's all. No, you don't know what you're talking about. The First Amendment only prevents you from being jailed for expressing your free speech, your free expression, your freedom of religion, etc. That's all it does. It does not protect you from your employer. He is exactly Correct. Welcome to the Extravaganza Radio on ESPN 106.5 The Dig. Here we are, Toledo sports leader. Hope you're having an outstanding Tuesday, and it's a better day than last night was for guys like Cushlin, guys like me, guys who roll with the tribe, guys who were riding high in a 22-game winning streak, best in American League history, guys who are looking at the 102 wins, one of the best seasons in franchise history, and guys who were saying it ought to be a cakewalk to the American League Championship Series. Well, they'll play the previous best team in the American League for most of the season, the Houston Astros, especially when you have a two-game lead, two games done lead over the New York Yankees. Guys like us, well, we kind of forget sometimes the doom and the gloom that overshadows like a big black cloud the teams and the city from which we come and the teams that we continue to support deep into our lives. You got to remember, Cushlin, this is still a Cleveland team that you're rooting for. It's still a Cleveland team that I'm rooting for. And as such, if something can go wrong, you must expect that something will go wrong. And last night, something went wrong. That something is the team that won 102 baseball games, including 22 in a row, and hasn't lost back-to-back baseball games since August. That's right. They haven't lost back-to-back games since August. Mid-August, by the way, forgot how to play baseball. They forgot how to catch line drives coming at their leg. Urshela. They forgot how to throw from third base to first base without airmailing it into the fifth row. Giovanni Urshela. To get the third out of an inning. They forgot how to not bounce the ball to first base when there's a dribbler back to the mound. Danny Salazar. They forgot how to play the game in the fundamental way that they had played it all season long on their way to 102 wins. So, yeah, I would say that is something that can go wrong. If a team can blow a 3-1 lead in the World Series with home field advantage, with game number 7, if it comes down to it being in your yard, and then find a way the very next season to blow a 2-0 lead in a division series with home field advantage. If that can happen, if that can go wrong, it will go wrong if the team you are rooting for hails from out there in Cleveland. We have learned this so many times, painful moment after painful moment. From the 1997 World Series in Mesa, the 2007 ALCS with a 3-1 lead against the Red Sox with back-to-back starts coming from your Cy Young Award winner Sabathia, the fourth-place finisher for that award in Carmona, followed by Westbrook, blowing that 3-1 lead, a series in which all you got to do is get by the Red Sox and you will roll the Rockies in the World Series as the Red Sox did. If it can be blown, it will be blown. And now the question is there a way to get out from underneath that dark cloud? Is there a way to not be schlep-rocked again? Is there a way to have confidence in the American League's could-be, would-be, should-be Cy Young Award winner that he will not lay the golden egg? Well, no, it wasn't a golden egg. It was a rotten egg that he laid in Game 2 of this series. That Corey Kluber will rebound and be the Klubot that everybody has come to know and love if you are a supporter of the Wahoos, friend of the feathered. And can the Indians hitters finally remember how they got to the blasted postseason when they face CC Sabathia tomorrow for the second time in a series? Will Jose Ramirez remember that he's the guy that's supposed to be an MVP candidate? Because he hasn't swung the bat like one in this division series. He's invisible. Will Francisco Lindor live off of the one swing for the entire series? I might be wrong on this, but I don't have it right in front of me. But Cushlin, I think it's entirely possible that in four games of this American League Division Series, Francisco Lindor has one hit. It was a big one. It was the salami to make an 8-3 game an 8-7 game and propelled the Indians onto an unlikely comeback win in 13 innings in game two.
And you are correct.
Is that his only hit?
That is indeed Francisco Lindor's only hit. He is 1-14.
He's 1-14, and I think Jose Ramirez is something similar, is he not?
Yeah, let me look up his exact number.
I think Ramirez might only have a hit. He might only have one, maybe two. I think one. I mean, honestly, the biggest
bat. He is 2-17.
What is he?
2-17.
He's got a pair. Isn't that just super? Edwin Encarnacion, of course, is AWOL. Well, not AWOL. He didn't leave without permission. He's just not able to play. He rolled his ankle because he decided not to dive back. He decided to go back without sliding on a pickoff play. Or not a pickoff play, but a hustling back so he didn't get doubled off second base.
Which they reviewed, and he was doubled off anyway.
Right. But he rolled his ankle. He hasn't been able to go since the first game, which is just horrific.
Actually, that was the first inning of game two.
Oh, that's right. Thank you. So, you know, the team that won 102 baseball games is not batting. They're not hitting like the dangerous lineup from top to bottom that they have been. Encarnacion's absence is huge, yes. Should it be an excuse for everybody else not to be hitting? No, it should not. Are the Yankees that damned good? No, they're not. Is Masahiro Tanaka, you know, a Clayton Kershaw reincarnated? No, he has an ERA coming into this series of 4.59 for this year. And then he locked him up. And then yesterday, Luis Severino, who got hammered in his only postseason start of his career a week earlier, looks like... I don't know, Pedro Martinez. And now, the large one, CC, cotton candy. Candy caramel. What's his name? Oh, Karsten Charles. Yeah, that's it. The rotund one, the one whose nickname is Dunlap because his belly Dunlap over the top of his belt buckle. And he's still getting guys out. 10 years after being traded, he's still getting guys out. Is he going to do it again to this team? I got to tell you, Kush, I want all of the optimism in the world. I really do. I want to feel like, you know what? All the Yankees did was what the Indians did. Took care of their home field. They won their two. The Indians won their two. Now it's back in the friendly confines, to borrow a phrase, of Progressive Field out there in Cleveland. 34,000 or so are going to be going ballistic. Corey Kluber is going to be dealing. He's got something to make up for. He knows it. Here's a little bit for the optimistic part, Jim. Corey Kluber started in game two, as I mentioned to Maniloff yesterday. He started in game two on 6 days' rest. It has been made very clear that Corey Kluber prefers not to go short or long. He likes his five-day routine. He did not have his five-day routine when he started game two. It was a six-day rest period. So, therefore, he pitched on the sixth day, I should say. So, if that is a factor or was a factor, it should not be a factor tomorrow, because tomorrow would indeed be his regular every five-day start. He's back on his own regular schedule, you know, the schedule that starters get used to in the regular season when you go every fifth game or every fifth day. So maybe that is a reason for optimism. Sabathia will be in the same boat. But that's all I've got, because I don't have any optimism in Giovanni Urshela being able to be a major league hitter. He's only here because he's a tremendous fielder, and now he makes two errors in a game. You think his confidence level is going to be high when somebody hits a rocket at the hot corner tomorrow? No, neither do I. Do I want to start Eric Gonzalez there? No, not really.
Honestly, I'd like to put Jackson in center, Kipnis back at second, and Jose at third, but I don't think Tito would do that.
I want to see Tito Francona go back to the lineup that this team was built around. Do I want to see Jose Ramirez be at third base again? Yes, I do. Do I want to see Jason Kipnis back at second base again? Yes, I do. Is that a commentary on Ramirez's ability to play second base with Lindor in the middle of that defense. No, it is not. They are terrific. But as we saw yesterday on that short, shallow sacrifice fly to Kipnis in center, when he couldn't even gun down Todd Frazier, down goes Frazier. No, 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 no. Well, okay, he went down to slide, but he popped up with a run because Jason Kipnis, great all-around ball player, made a diving catch. Was that in game two or game one, Coach?
That was game one.
Game one, a spectacular play where you say, my gosh, for a guy who's not an outfielder, that was one hail of an athletic outfield center field play. But there is something about knowing how to come in and make the transition on a fly ball in a sack fly situation to get that gun off faster, to come up firing without the hitch and the delay in the transition. And he doesn't have it, and it cost them a run yesterday. Not that it would have been just the one winning run, but as we understand, every run matters. Would I like to see Austin Jackson back in center? Yes, I would. Would I like to see the Indians' pitching rotation back in its regular pitching rotation rather than starting a Bauer on short rest? Rather than using Tomlin out of the bullpen again? Rather than using Salazar out of the bullpen? All of these strange little oddities that Tito Francona is doing with this baseball team that was the best in baseball in the second half and the best in the American League for the season, all of these strange little changes that he's making, and we said, Jim Cushlin, did we not at the start of this series, we know Tito's right and we're wrong, but I've got some questions about this.
That's pretty much exactly how we said it.
I'm sorry?
That's pretty much exactly how we said it.
Yeah, I mean, I'll fully admit, I'm a baseball novice compared to Tito Francona. Now, compared to your average fan, I think I'm pretty good because I've been studying the game for a long time. I've studied the nuances of the game. I've worked around players for a long time. I've worked around clubhouses and on network broadcasts. I kind of study the game pretty good. But compared to Tito Francona, yeah, my baseball knowledge compared to Terry Francona's baseball knowledge is my physics knowledge compared to Stephen Hawking. I was trying to remember the guy in the wheelchair. Stephen Hawking's physics knowledge, okay? He's just got that much more than I do. So I readily admit I'm sure I'm wrong about the decisions that he's making on positioning, replacing Edwin Encarnacion at the dish when he's out with Michael Brantley, who is simply not healthy enough to get four ABs in a game.
He's one for 11.
One for 11, thank you. I know I'm wrong, right? I admit it. Tito knows more than me. But here we are. And it's game five, and some stuff happened, Jim Cushlin, that I saw in games three and four that I feel like shouldn't have happened had Tito been listening to me. And I know I'm going to be struck by lightning from the baseball gods. The baseball god Zeus is going to hit me with a lightning bolt for daring to question the wisdom of a Hall of Fame manager in waiting. But I kind of feel like I was right in a couple of these decisions. And we'll see if I was right tomorrow at about 11 p.m. Well, I'm assuming. What time is that game tomorrow? Is
that That's 7? An 8 o'clock start, 7:30 pregame. We'll have it here on the ticket.
So probably probably 11:30 midnight type of time frame.
Most likely these drag on in the playoffs for extra commercials and all the other junk.
That's when we'll know if I was right or if Terry Francona was right. Because if Corey Kluber goes out there and executes a Corey Kluber type of game plan against this lineup, and he's out there and he's got his slider and his curveball working, and he's pinpoint location with his fastball, and he's moving guys up and down and in and out the way only Corey Kluber can do it, and he carves up the New York Yankees and leads the Indians to a game five win, then I will say, you know what, that's what I was talking about. Terry Francona, my apologies for ever questioning you when you started Trevor Bauer game one, Corey Kluber game two, the reason being that if Corey Kluber went in game two, he'd be on his regular rest to start game five. And I will eat all of the rest of it with the bullpen and the Salazar and the Clevinger not being a starter and all of the other stuff I question. And the Brantley and the Kipnis and the Ramirez and the Urshela and all that nonsense. I will shut up. I will eat my my words, and I will say, you know what, Tito, I'll kiss the ring. That's what I'll do. I'll kiss the ring. Let me have the ring, sir. I'll get down on one knee and kiss the ring. And that's what I am hoping for, Kush. I was just disgusted last night. I feel bad for Trevor Bauer. I do. I'm not mad at Trevor Bauer. A lot of people like to get mad at the starter if they don't get it done. We know this. Yankee fans booed Severino after the wild card game when he came, I mean, mercilessly. You know, I mean, it's if you don't get it done, you're going to hear it even from your home crowd. And you know what? I'm not going to rip Trevor Bauer. He was asked to go on short rest. He, of course, is very, very game and ready to go. Did not have his best stuff. Did not get much help from his defense, and it turned out ugly for him, and it puts the Indians in a really rough situation. But be that as it may, it's not a Trevor Bauer problem. Yesterday was a Tito problem for me, and yesterday was a fundamental baseball problem for the Cleveland Indians. They just didn't look like the American League Central champion.
Yeah, real quick on that front, for what it's worth, both Tito and Bauer post-game said something to the effect, and you heard some of that in the montage, that they even thought and saw his stuff a little better than it was in Game 1. The problem is when you give extra outs and... Yep. Then the whole ball gets rolling. That's exactly what happened in that second inning. Once the error happened, and we've seen this out of Bauer in the past, when something not his fault goes wrong, like it did in that second inning yesterday, then the bottom falls out sometimes with him. So I've seen that before. So I'm not going to totally blame Bauer on this one. And you know, it's piggybacking on something you said a few minutes ago, trying to be optimistic. But feeling the dark cloud thing, the only optimism I have, Bob, is twofold. One, I can't imagine Corey Kluber's going to have another stinker like that tomorrow night. I calculated it. Especially if you don't count the seventh game last year in the World Series, that Game 2 outing for Kluber, worst start of any kind since 2013. I had to look it up to see the last time he gave up that many runs in a single game. It was September of 2013. So that's one. Two, the Yankees are very, very good home. They have the best record in the league at home, and that's what you're supposed to do, is take care of business at home. Outside of that, I'm very pessimistic about this one. I have the same feeling I did the Tuesday night going into Wednesday last year between Game 6 and 7, where I knew I was going to sit through it, but I just had the awful gut feeling going on. And speaking of dark clouds, you mentioned some of the ones that they blew, the three ones. Actually, the more appropriate comparison, and I tweeted this out last night, is this is starting to eerily remind me of that 99 collapse against Boston. The same up 2-0 at home, get housed at Fenway. The only difference between that series and this one is the Indians have a Corey Kluber, not a Charles Nagy. And there's no Pedro coming out of that Yankee pen off an injury to save them.
That's a good point.
But that's the more apt comparison, honestly.
Yeah, that's a very good point. That is a good comparison. I kind of forgot about the 99 one. Skipped right over that after 97 and skipping to 2007. But the sad point is, Jim, that there's another one that works. There's too many of these to look back on.
I just feel the most appropriate is 99 because we're dealing with best of five division series.
Exactly. So, yeah, it is. It's a very appropriate one. So it's going to be tough. It's going to be very, very tough, no question about it. It's going to be a tough 24 hours between now and tomorrow night at 8 o'clock, by the way, more than 24 hours, kind of waiting and waiting and thinking about all the terrible things that can happen. You just want to get it done.
And being that that's what Cleveland fans are used to, thinking about that terrible, I'll admit something to tinker around with today. If they blow this, does this team make massive changes? Because there's not a lot of free agents. Most of the team is back for next year and the year after.
What massive changes would you want to make? I mean, no, I'm not making massive changes. I'm very, very happy with the vast majority. I mean, the only thing I change is take Jay Bruce from being a rental to being a full-time player. You give him a big deal and you keep him in town. I'm keeping my rotation.
If you do that, if I were to do that with you, then I would not be picking up the option that's on Michael Brantley. I believe he has an option this winter.
I don't know that that's right. If that's right, I would agree with you because of the injuries just being such a big question mark. Yeah, and, you know, they're going to have to figure out Carlos Santana, too.
Yep, he's a free agent.
How much is he going to be worth because he's a free agent, too? So their big changes would be more... Not really changes. It would be just more.
And yes, Brantley has a $12 million club option for next year.
Is that what it is?
Yes, indeed.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, No, I don't think they'd make any big changes. What big changes do you want to make? I mean, you know,
there's not many to make because most of the club is signed for next year,
healthy,
year after with minimal free agents.
Right, yeah. If everybody's healthy, you just keep coming back and doing this again and hope you don't have a bad game at the wrong time in a postseason game like this, because I think next year, if this team comes back as is, or even minus Brantley, as you're pointing out, if they come back as is, they're easily the favorite in the American League Central again. They'll be back in the playoffs again next year. There's no doubt in my mind.
That's no question. In fact, you got Kluber locked. The next 2 years.
You got Kluber locked. You got Carrasco locked. You got Bauer locked. You got Clevenger locked. You got Tomlin locked. You keep that together. You still have the best bullpen. I don't think any of those guys are going anywhere.
Brian Shaw's the only one I can think of that's a free agent. Well, Joe Smith, but they later acquired him.
Right, right, right. And we'll see, you know, what he's worth on the open market and whether they want to do that. But, you know, Encarnacion is locked. Santana, like I said, he'd have to deal with him and or Bruce. You got Chisenhall. You got Kipnis under contract. Chiz, Ramirez.
Lindor's still under team control, only making $600,000, for goodness sake.
Yeah, no, I don't think there'd be any big changes at all. If it doesn't work, they'll just say, all right, we didn't get it done, but let's come back and go at it again. Like, just like they did at the end of the World Series last. They blew it and up 3-1, lost game 7. Did they make big changes? Yeah, they went out and got in Edwin Encarnacion. that's a good change. I don't think there would be any reason whatsoever to do anything rash with this team, considering you know what they've done in the last 2 years, back-to-back division championships, and would absolutely be the favorite to come back and do it again next year. No doubt.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that, but, you know, had to obligatory throw that out there.
Yep. Okay, you gave an interesting stat a few moments ago about Corey Kluber the last time he gave up those runs, but it wasn't a wild stat. Let's do the wild stat.
ESPN 106.5 The Ticket presents The Wild Stat of the Day, brought to you by Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports.
Buffalo Wild Wings Wild Stat of the Day today. Last night in the Game 4 loss, the Indians gave up a season-high 6 unearned runs on those 4 errors. Very abnormal for a team in 2017 that had the lowest number of errors committed in baseball at just 76, and the fewest number of unearned runs allowed this season with just 35. Wrong night to have all of that be flipped on its ear. But that is your Buffalo Wild Wings Wild Stat of the Day. All right, we got a lot of good things coming up. I want to get you on the phones. I want to ask this question of Tiger fans. Are you rooting for the Tribe? Or do you love this? Since they are division rivals, and they are regional rivals in a manner of speaking, just, you know, a couple hours apart. Are you loving this, or are you rooting for the Indians over the Yankees? There's no way, I can't imagine, any Tigers fan in the sound of my voice right now rooting for the New York Yankees. I would hope you hate the Yankees like every red-blooded American hates the Yankees that is not from New York. Are you rooting for the Tribe or the Yankees? We're going to talk about that as we continue right here on the...
Be part of the extravaganza right now by calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
Yes, indeed. Rolling along now at 3:43 on the extravaganza. Hope you're having an outstanding day. I bet I can make your day even better. You want to know how? By helping you avoid the cold weather this year. All right? Car Stereo One wants to help you do that. You know how? By avoiding the scraping the ice off of the snow and the snow off of the windows while you wait for your car to warm up when winter hits. Why and how? With a remote car starter from Car Stereo One. That's right. Get the engine started long before you leave the house or the building. Get the window defroster going and warm up the inside so you're nice and toasty when it's time to hit the road. Steve and his staff at Car Stereo One can set you up with a remote car starter using your own smartphone for just $195 installed. It's amazing. Now, if you want, you can wait and pay about, $300 for the same thing later in the winter when it's already cold, or you can save money and get it done right now. Get your remote car starter operated by your own smartphone for just $195 installed now at Car Stereo One on Central, just a block east of Secor. Need directions? Get them at carstereo1.com. Turtle. All right, so that's great advice, by the way. All right, so a lot of other things to get into today. Obviously, we're talking about baseball, and we're talking about the American League Division Series that the Indians has put into grave jeopardy now. It is a very, very disturbing moment right now for Indians fans. But I want to shift gears just briefly. Well, not entirely. Let me back up 2 seconds here. I do want to hear from Tigers fans. If you are a Tiger fan, I really want to know if you are enjoying the Indians' collapse because they're a rival. Okay, because they're a geographical rival. They're a obviously a division rival in the American League Central. You know, and while there's room for Tigers and Indians fans to be friends, it's not like it's, you know, Yankee fans, which we all hate. That's kind of the point of all of this thing. A lot of Tigers fans, if they can't see their team do well, well, they don't want their rival to do well either. But the flip side of that is nobody can be rooting for the Yankees, right? I mean, honestly, I don't care who you are. If you're in Northwest Ohio, if you're from Northeast Ohio, like Cushlin and I are, and we both root for the Indians already, if the Tigers were playing the Yankees, it's a no-brainer. Go Tigers. Hell, if the Marlins were playing the Yankees, if the Padres were playing the Yankees, if the Royals or the Twins, I don't care. If the Mudhens were playing the Yankees, it's go whatever is playing New York.
Now, if it's a Red Sox-Yankees, are we rooting for, like, the stadium to be destroyed
or
something?
Yes, I am. Yes, I am. Honest to God, I swear that's exactly correct. You know, it's just like, don't, you know, I don't want anybody to get hurt when I say for the stadium to blow up, but I mean, seriously, in a figurative sort of way, not a literal sort of way.
Right,
just
right,
blow
yes.
it up. What's that?
Right, yes, yes. I don't want fans hurt or anything,
exactly.
But...
Just, you know, I don't want anybody to win, or at least I want it to be the worst played series ever with each team committing 9 errors in each game, and the only team that wins is the team that, you know, makes the last least, or I should say that doesn't make the very last error, kind of those things, just so they can't even enjoy it, where they're having a parade and they're going, yay, we didn't suck as bad as the other guys did. I mean, there's no other way to do that with those teams. But that isn't the situation now. It's the Indians and the Yankees, and I want to know where Tigers fans are. Are you rooting for the Indians to finish this thing off against the Yankees, or are you loving the fact that they are collapsing because you have the division rivalry going on? 866-240-1065. That's the number. 866-240-1065. I'd love to get your thoughts on that. Now to shift gears for just a moment into something else. If you want to dial, do it while I talk about DeShone Kizer. Kush, I don't know if you read David Briggs and the Blade today. Did you read this?
I did catch part of it, yeah.
I like Briggs. We should have got him on. Probably should have called him. David Briggs, sports columnist for The Blade, obviously. Headline, Browns make big mistake benching Kizer. Okay. I'll hear him out. David writes, remember when the Browns coach Hugh Jackson told us he would ride with DeShone Kizer through thick, thin, and everything in between? Quote, this is not just for the moment, Jackson said in late August, appointing the Central Catholic graduate as the starting quarterback. We're going to get with DeShone and ride with him through it all. We know now, or now know, that was a lie, David writes. Just when you think the hapless Browns, 0-5, couldn't descend any lower, they benched Kizer after a bad first half in their 17-14 loss to the Jets on Sunday. 2 days later, as Jackson said, he's undecided on the quarterback situation. I'm still confounded. Look, I know Kizer has made more than his share of mistakes. His passer rating is 50.9, the worst in the league. But when you surround a gifted but raw talent with an inferior cast, including a roster of receivers who would not so much as make the practice squad elsewhere, and then toss him into the flames before he's ready, what did the Browns truly expect? This was always going to be a process, David Briggs writes. When the Browns made their commitment to Kizer, they needed to throw the franchise's full weight and support behind him this season and not turn back. The only way for Kizer to improve is to keep playing. If he doesn't prove the answer, fine. Draft another quarterback in next year's draft. But the Browns need to find out if he is, and we still believe he can be. Not surrender or surrender hope after 5 weeks. Jackson benching a possible quarterback of the future in the hope of a spark from one who is not, Kevin Hogan, was the desperate move of another desperate Browns coach who, after all the talk of a stable new era, realizes he might not survive another 1-15 season. At Cleveland's Factory of Sadness, some things never change. That's the short little column today from David Briggs. Again, a lot of respect for Briggsy, so I'm not ripping Briggsy when I say this, but I'm going to have to say I've got some issues with some of what he wrote. I'm curious to see if you do, too, at 866-240-1065. With all due deference to, you know, the fact that DeShone Kizer is a native son, with the fact that he is a Central Catholic grad, the pride of the Fighting Irish, games you hear each and every week, all season long, right here on the ticket. We love him, and we want to see him be successful. Nobody wanted him to be more successful, obviously, than Browns fans, particularly Browns fans like me and Kush, you know, who, again, are loyal to our hometown teams that we grew up with, but also loyal to Cleveland products like, well, it's kind of like Michael Roberts being up in Detroit. It's kind of like Kareem Hunt being at Kansas City and tearing it up because they're from the University of Toledo. But in this case, DeShone is from Toledo and a Central Catholic guy. So, of course, we wanted to see him succeed. Having said all that, do you really think that Hugh Jackson is making a mistake here? Now, the optics of it, I think, are very clear. Briggs is right. that when Jackson said, we're going to ride with Deshaun, or I'm sorry, quote, we're going to get with Deshaun and ride with him through it all, it looks bad for him to say, okay, we're going to Kevin Hogan now. But I disagree with Briggs on the core of this, not the optics of it, not the facade. I disagree because I don't necessarily think trotting him out there under the circumstances that he's been playing thus far is going to help him grow. He talks about the passer's mistakes. He talks about the passer rating being 50.9, worse than the league. Talks about the completion percentage being worse than the league. Talk about the turnovers being terrible, especially down inside the red zone. All of those things are true. Talks about including a roster of receivers that would not make the practice squad elsewhere. That is also true. And tossing him into the flames before he is ready. What did the Browns truly expect? And I think therein lies the rub. This is where my disagreement comes in. He's right. Deshaun Kizer isn't ready. It was the belief of a lot of people back in training camp that Deshaun Kizer wasn't ready. That Brock Osweiler, while not being a necessarily sound investment of $16 million, was at least the perfect stopgap, you know, kind of fill in the blank
placeholder,
for a little while
yeah.
guy, the placeholder, yes, Jim. You know, that that they needed while Deshaun Kizer got ready by watching the game and learning NFL defenses from the sideline, from quarterback meetings, from watching Osweiler and talking to him, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He's not ready. And because he's not ready, is it better to keep him out there in a sixth game and a seventh game and an eighth game and a ninth game and a tenth game, continuing to make mistakes with the same group of receivers that aren't good enough to be practice squad receivers? With the same offense that is completely without direction or a rudder because Hugh Jackson refuses to hire an offensive coordinator and wants to do it all himself? Is it better to put him out there under those circumstances for five more or 10 more since he's or 11 since he's played five? Is that wise, or would that destroy the confidence that Deshaun Kizer could ever hope to recover? This was always going to be a process, David Briggs writes. When the Browns made their commitment to Kizer, they needed to throw the franchise's full weight and support behind him this season and not turn back. I think that's faulty thinking. I think that's flawed logic. Sometimes you have to turn back. Once you realize you're going down a road that is going to lead to disaster, you've got to turn back and find a new road. Or at least regather yourself and then restart your way down the road again later. Once you have your bearings, if you don't have a GPS, find a way to get a sundial, or not a sundial, that tells time, but a compass. Isn't there a way? I think there's a way to make a homemade compass. But find your new direction, figure out where you're going, after you step back for a little while. If I start my way down a road and say, I'm committed to this road, and I get near the end of it and I see that it's a cliff, there's a cliff at the end of it with no guardrail, and if I keep going down that road, I'm going to plummet to my death. Do I want to say, I said I was committed to it, damn it, I'm committed to it, or do I turn around and go back and say, I better find another way? I might want to find another way. And that doesn't mean bench Kizer forever, and it doesn't mean give up on him. He can't play in the NFL anymore. We have now decided, you know, the opposite of what we did before. We thought he was ready, and now we don't think he'll ever be ready, but how about just he wasn't ready, but he will be once we give him a new look at things, once we get back and look for a different road to go down. The only way for Kizer to improve, writes Dave, is to keep playing. I don't agree with that in every case. It is the case for some guys. Peyton Manning threw close to 30 interceptions, I think, his rookie season. Almost to a game. The only way for him to get better was indeed to keep playing. Troy Aikman went 1-15 in his first season for the Cowboys. The only way for that guy to get better was to keep playing. Deshaun Kizer is neither of those guys. And this circumstance is unlike in anything that those other guys went through. This is a season of failure for whomever is at the helm. Because the ship is rudderless. Jimmy and Dee Haslam have no earthly idea what they're doing as owners. Sashi Brown, Paul DePodesta have no idea what they're doing in the front office. And quite frankly, Hugh Jackson without an offense coordinator has no idea what he's doing with DeShone Kizer. I don't think this is a situation where Kizer can succeed, at least with any modicum of, you know, confidence-building play. I just don't. I think they need to watch Kevin Hogan for a little while, not to evaluate whether he's better than Kizer, but just let him play, let DeShone Kizer learn from watching Hogan, watching the mistakes he makes, just reading defenses from the sideline rather than under duress, trying to figure these things out to make himself a more accurate passer, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All of those things need to be done before he gets back out there under center again. Now, do I think he needs to sit the rest of the season? No. How many games is the right number? I don't know. Two? Four? Half the season? Bring him back for the final five? Let him play five? Sit six? And then play the last five, having learned a little bit more, maybe something like that. That's, you know, and maybe Kevin Hogan's play will determine that. Maybe that's the answer to the question. But I don't think that the, quote, only way for Kizer to improve is to keep playing. I don't think that is the case. Not right now, anyway. Benching him might do better, more for, you know, it's weird. When somebody gets benched, when somebody tells you you're not good right now, go take a powder. Whether it's a starting pitcher getting knocked around and in the second inning, the manager coming to the mound and asking for the ball, it sucks to be told you don't have it. It sucks. Sometimes it's bad for your confidence, particularly if you're a young quarterback, second-round pick being expected to start and do great things right away on a crappy roster with a crappy, less-than-talented team. But you know what sucks even more than being told at that moment in time, go sit down? Being told keep going out there and doing it again and again and again. A beatdown after a beatdown after a beatdown. More games of multiple interceptions. More games of multiple turnovers. More games of below 50% passing completion rate, completion percentage. More games of 47.2 passer ratings. Those things suck worse than being told that you kind of suck right now, go sit down. Because then you are reminded each week that you suck and it's not getting better. And that will wear on a young kid's confidence in a very, very big way. Now, I don't know DeShone Kizer. I've never met DeShone Kizer. I don't know what his confidence level is. I don't know how he does what he does. But for most guys, it's a beatdown to have the situation like they have in Cleveland, where it's the literally the worst franchise in all of team sports. Even Maniloff agreed with that yesterday. Worst franchise in all of team sports in North America, and I think we could probably say football, basketball, baseball, hockey, and I'll even say soccer, and I don't know a damn thing about a soccer team. But the Browns are run worse than any soccer team has run. They are worse at football than any hockey team is at hockey, any soccer team is at soccer, and probably any two-man drunken cornhole team is in an afternoon picnic. They are worse at what they do than anybody else is at what they do. That's a tough thing for DeShone Kizer to overcome. Kush, do you think it's Briggs, right? Did they make a mistake by yanking Kizer at halftime? And are they making a mistake by starting Kevin Hogan this coming week against Houston?
There's so many small things that get to me that get lumped together that you have to then take out. First of all, I think the very first thing that comes into my mind as I'm reading this article and hearing you talk about it is, first of all, first indictment, back to the front office. I'd rather see Deshaun Watson be failing at this right now than a Kizer or somebody else. Proving once again, the Browns screwed up by not taking that quarterback high, which is something that I have been saying this team has to do. I don't care who it is. Start him for a year or two, let the chips fall where they may, and they still won't do it. Number two, yes, obviously anybody, Kizer, Watson, Hogan, insert name here, is going to have their struggles given the quote-unquote massive use of air quotes there, talent that is on this team. So you're set up to fail in many ways, you know, already. But at the same time, I've been disagreeing with the looking like it's going to be Hogan now, you know, starting, because you made the decision to go with Kizer. You got to stick with it. I actually think it'll, regardless of the lack of talent on this team, I think it might actually do him more harm to being yanked and then probably by the end of the season thrown back in there when the quote unquote talent will be even less due to injuries. I don't know. I think this is becoming a wasted opportunity to really see if this kid can do it. You know, if he has the talent to make some plays when he's got no talent around him.
Well, I mean, you said it yourself. He has no talent around him, none whatsoever. So why make him learn under duress with no talent around him? Why make him learn under fire when he is almost guaranteed failure? He's almost guaranteed
failure. I mean, that's a
great
question, and I don't have a good answer
for that. Rather
than
let him learn a little bit without being under duress, watch somebody else run for his life for a little while. Watch somebody else make the read, see if you can make him a little quicker. And then when he comes over, say, hey, what did you see there, and how did you know to go that way? Because that's the traditional learning curve for a rookie quarterback, especially a raw one.
Yeah.
Whom there were questions about whether or not he should come out a little bit early for the NFL draft in the first place.
Yeah. And again, I have no good answer for that. I just keep thinking that you made the decision already. You should stick with it.
Even though there's a cliff at the end of that road, you made your decision to march down.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I do, because these are painful things at that position specifically that the Browns, the organization, and the coaching staff need to just suck it up and do it.
Yeah, I don't think you want to wreck a young kid in the course of doing that. And I think you could wreck him in a very, very bad way. I really, really do. And you're right, though. I would like to see Deshaun Watson sucking right now instead of being second in the NFL with 12 touchdown passes.
And I believe one interception or something? It's low. It's a very low number. I know that.
Four.
Oh, it's four. Okay.
Yeah, 12-4 right now in a QB rating. In this rookie season right now at this stage of 100.7. He's one of the tops in the league, which is pretty amazing in that regard. But you know, then there's the flip side. Did you watch any Monday Night Football last night in between innings for the Indians?
I did catch a little bit of it because I couldn't stand watching that Indians game at times.
Mitch Trubisky, of course, made his debut. He was the first quarterback taken in this draft. By the Chicago Bears, who moved up to get him, shocking a lot of people. Why would you do that if you just signed Mike Glennon? Well, now you've seen Mike Glennon play a little bit. There's a reason. So they go to Mitchell Trubisky. Now, Trubisky is in a little bit of a different situation. Oh, my God, it's 4:02, and I didn't realize. Kush, we got to get out. Apologies. We do need to take a time out here, but I'll talk more about Trubisky and more about rookie quarterbacks in a minute. But before we go to the top of the hour local sports center, I want to remind you about the 4K a day. We want to put $1,000 in your back pocket four times a day. It's the 4K a day. Listen weekdays at 9 a.m., noon, 3 p.m., and 6 p.m. for a keyword. When you hear that keyword, text it to 62582, 62582 for your chance at $1,000 four times a day. That's the 4K a day only from ESPN 106.5, The Ticket. All right, we got a top of the hour sports center coming your way. On the other side of that, I want to get some of your phone calls going on this matter. I want to talk a little bit more baseball as well. And oh, by the way, the Bowling Green State University Falcons are no longer winless. They got their first dub of the year against Miami, and Mike Jenks, head coach of the Falcons, will be around about 4:45 to talk about that coming up as we continue.
Overall, it didn't work out very well. I thought he came out of the chute with real good stuff when we gave up the four. You know, he threw a lot of pitches in the inning, and I thought he was starting to go to his breaking ball too much, and it looked to me like they started to hunt it. Like they knew he was going to throw it, and he left a couple up, and those are the ones that hurt him. The whole night, we made it hard on ourselves to win. Kept trying, but we kept shooting ourselves in the foot. What we ultimately care about is when it's over, we're one run better than them, however we do it. Yeah, it's hard to imagine giving it to somebody better. You know, we tried to set up for a five-game series with plans, contingency plans. You know, we go to game five, we're at home, and we have Kluber. We're looking forward to it.
I thought my stuff was better than game one tonight. Vila was up. Curveball had more depth to it, I thought. I located pretty well. A couple little things went their way instead of mine. I think just as a team, we didn't play the greatest defense tonight, too. You know, little things in baseball games that beat you in the playoffs, you know.
We're still confident. You know, we believe in what we have. We believe that we're capable of doing. That was a good thing of winning the first two games, that we still got a chance. Can't be perfect every day. You hope and you practice and you work as hard as you can to try to be perfect. It's part of the game, you know. Sometimes you're going to make mistakes, and you just got to find a way to minimize them.
We didn't play, you know, with defense. I believe in this team. Corey Kluber on the mound on Wednesday. I think I like our chances.
One of the biggest plus marks for our team is our defense. I mean, it happened. It's baseball. Things like that happen. It's time to move on. Got to put it in the rearview mirror, and I feel like we're still in the driver's seat going home to play game five. The regular season doesn't really matter, but we earned the right to play Game 5 at home, and that's something that we're going to embrace. It's a good team over there. We didn't think we were just going to be able to throw our gloves on the field, and they beat us tonight.
You know, they kind of clawed their way back into it. You know, they got it to 5-3, but we were able to add on, and that's really important against a club like this, that we were able to change the momentum back. The fact that we've been able to play in some of these games, I think, helped. You play in the game Minnesota, you play in a game where you're down 2-0, you're down 2-1, you're facing a guy that we really didn't do any the last time. I mean, obviously, we know we're facing a great pitcher, but there's a lot of confidence in that room, and they pick each other up, and they grind out at bats, and pitchers pick each other up, make big pitches. Should be a lot of fun Wednesday.
I think the Indians are in real trouble. As we focus so much on Girardi and that decision, I don't think there's been enough talk about how much the Indians really miss Edwin Encarnacion in the middle of their lineup. They're hoping that he pulls a Willis Reed, overcomes this injury, and plays in Game 5, because I think it's had a lot of ripple effects. I think Jose Ramirez, who's so great during the regular season, is putting a ton of pressure on himself. Certainly looks like Andrew Miller's not close to being what he was last year. You know, there's some whispers, something among the evaluators following this series that maybe Corey Kluber's hurt. Part of the reason why the Yankees chose Sabathia for Game 5 is the fact that Encarnacion is not in the Cleveland lineup.
There's one thing to do in action. There's another thing to make sure it can stand up under scrutiny of courts, under scrutiny of the league. And right now, there's nothing that permits them to be able to have that bright line rule that lets them say, hey, you can make a rule, sit a guy down, take his money. So that's where the fight's going to be. And even if the fight goes all the way through the NFL and goes through arbitration, as you know how that works, and if the NFL sides with Jerry Jones, you better believe it's a federal court fight. And there's a lot of other arguments that could come in that players could make to say, this is not fair. They could try to say that the rule is overbroad, that it's not defined clearly, and try to get the federal courts involved. So there's a difference between can you do it? I think he can do it. But can he enforce it and keep it and hold that rule in place? That's going to be a tough one. I think he can do it because this is a private agreement and it's not a public situation. So you talk about people say, well, you're limiting people's First Amendment rights. Kind of the old adage of, hey, you can say whatever you want, but you don't have a First Amendment right to a job.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
You know, I don't understand why he kept saying, can you do it? Can you do it? Can you do it? He's mispronouncing it all together.
Can you dig it?
That's what he's trying to say. Can you do it? No. Can you dig it? Dig it. D-I-G, dig it. That's what the Ryan Smith, the illegal counsel for ESPN, is trying to say. Welcome out, number two. Our number two. Easy for me to say, not so much for you, I'm sure. Underway. Don't forget, coming up in about a half an hour from now, at about 4:45, we're going to hear from head coach of the Bowling Green State Falcons as BG goes and gets their first win. On the road, by the way, at Miami. So congratulations to BG. They had started off 0-5, lost their first MAC game against Akron the week prior. And now they got OU at home, yep, back at the Dwight. As a matter of fact, Kush, what's that, Jim?
And no, all I was going to say, you're playing that. Bowling Green gets their first win of the year. I think that deserves.
Can you,
yes, it does,
dig it?
Fair enough. Yes, indeed, I can. And by the way, I've got tickets to Bowling Green on OU at the Dwight on Saturday. If you want them, I'm going to give them to you right before we go to Coach Jinx at about 4:35 or so, somewhere in that neighborhood. Okay, so be paying attention when I give you the cue to call. Don't dial now. It's not going to get you any good. Not going to do any good, I should say, but I'll be doing that coming up in about 20 minutes or so. Just listen for the cue to call. Oh, by the way, speaking of college football, I'm going to come back to the NFL and Ryan Smith there, the legal analyst for ESPN in a moment, on the national anthem and on Jerry Jones and all the rest. But back to the college football thing, since I just brought that up, a reminder for you that the Border Battle Contest is on again. That's right, the Ticket and Yuengling, with a chance for you to attend the Michigan-Ohio State Showdown November 25 in Ann Arbor at the Big House. With limo service provided from Total Image Limousine, outstanding. The runner-up prize, if you want the grand prize winner of this tremendous contest, runner-up gets a trip for two to the Big Ten Championship game, no matter who it may be, on December 2nd at Lucas Oil Stadium in Indy. So for a chance to qualify, register one time at the website, 1065theticket.com, or text Border Battle, one word, Border Battle, to the short code 64636. Save that, 64636. If you qualify, you'll be asked to attend our giveaway party on Thursday night, November 16th, at the Blarney downtown, at which time we will announce the winners of both the grand prize to the Big House or the runner-up prize to Lucas Oil Stadium in Indy. It's all brought to you by Yuengling, True House of Munch, Get Go Transportation, Churchill's Country Hearth, TAS Electronics, Distracted Haunted House, and your football freaks right here at the Ticket. Okay. So back to the national anthem issue. Since you had that in the montage, Kush, there is a little bit of a new development on this front. After a month plus now, about a month and a half or so of regular season ratings continuing to decline for ESPN and for the NFL in general, not just ESPN, but all the NFL broadcasts on Fox and CBS and whatnot, ratings are just going down. Sunday nighters on NBC, ratings are going down after a month of this. And after seeing that, this isn't going to be better anytime soon. Vice President Mike Pence, as you know, kind of set the example for a whole lot of people. Now, you know, and I'm not going to go straight political on this. I'm just going to point out the fact that Mike Pence is the vice president of Donald Trump. Donald Trump is the president because he won the presidency. Tens of millions of people like him, even if you don't. And I don't know if you do or you don't. Doesn't matter to me because, like I said, I'm not going political here on this. It's a matter of it's a point that's a matter of fact here. And the fact is that there are tens of millions of Americans who like Mike Pence and Donald Trump and who support what he did and who are going to emulate what Mike Pence did and walk away from the NFL. And I think it's that message that some of the other owners are starting to get. Stephen Ross, formerly a supporter of the protesters, being activists on the sideline before games, the owner of the Miami Dolphins, who has now said, yeah, we can't do this anymore. We really need for you guys to stand. The Dolphins have now been forbidden by their owner from kneeling, and the alternative, according to what Stephen Ross has told them, was if you don't want to stand for the national anthem, stay in the club or in the locker room or the tunnel until it's over. But don't be kneeling on the sideline. We don't want it. We don't want the headaches. We don't want the problems. It's disrespectful. Don't do it. Jerry Jones has taken this a step up. Jerry Jones has flat out told his team, issued an ultimatum, said you will stand for the national anthem, show respect to the flag and our country, or you will not play. And I don't think he means I'm going to give you a paid day off. He said you will be benched and you will not get paid. Will in essence be a one-game suspension if you choose to do this. That has lit up, obviously, this conversation like never before, and it's already been very, very hot. But the conversation has taken new turns. Jemele Hill, as we talked about yesterday, ESPN talk show host slash anchor, went on Twitter and said we should boycott the Dallas Cowboys advertisers. ESPN said, oh, boy, you can't do that. Now we're in some serious trouble. You've already used Twitter twice for very, very negative reasons. You're suspended for two weeks, beg your pardon. That, of course, has a lot of people who are on the social justice warrior side of the aisle with Jemele Hill talking about boycotting the NFL and boycotting ESPN. Already, conservative-minded people who support standing for the anthem and oppose the protesters have said, what? We're boycotting the NFL and we're boycotting ESPN. So, needless to say, there's a whole bunch of issues here that are going to have to be resolved. And now we go to the breaking news today. Roger Goodell. Roger Goodell, the wishy-washy, mealy-mouthed commissioner, owner's puppet that he is, who has been so, you know, reticent to taking a stand on this, doesn't want to alienate the players, but doesn't want to alienate the fans, tried to do what Jerry Jones did, trying to play both sides, essentially. Roger Goodell is now saying he wants all players to stand for the national anthem. What brought on this change of heart from Roger Goodell? Well, in truth, I think I already laid that out for you. Dollars. He sees the boycott growing bigger. He knows that there is a Veterans Day boycott that has been called for that already has 120-some thousand people signed up for to boycott NFL games on Veterans Day weekend. That's a big deal. That's a really big deal. So Roger Goodell, the commissioner of the National Football League, says it's time to get past this stuff and start standing and respecting the country again. Here's a report from ESPN.
While all this was happening, there was also some news about what happens before the game start. Roger Goodell sending out a memo to owners about some changes perhaps coming to the national anthem and the participation there. What can you tell us?
Here's what's happening, Trey. The NFL right now is considering a proposal that would change the wording in its operations manual, and it would make it such that the players would be required to stand for the national anthem. Now, next week, we've got a situation here where at that point in time, owners are meeting in New York. They're going to discuss changing the word should to must stand. We'll see how that's received.
Should stand versus must stand. Oh, this is going to get it going. And that's what Ryan Smith, the ESPN legal analyst, was talking about in that clip that you heard there at the end of the montage that Cushlin put together. Speaking specifically, can Jerry Jones, the owner of the Cowboys, require his players to stand for the national anthem or be benched without pay? Can Roger Goodell require players to stand for the national anthem or face some sort of a punitive action if they change the language in the operations manual, which now says players should stand, you know, and should is the operative word, but players should stand at attention with their helmet under their arm and the hand either over their heart or at their side while the national anthem is sung and the colors are presented. Pretty standard stuff. This is what the NBA has. This is what Major League Baseball has. But perhaps those other sports don't have the word should. They have the word must or are required to. And that's what they are talking about doing now. Will the owners go along with it? I guarantee you they want to. I promise you there is not one owner, even a more politically left of center owner like Stephen Ross, who would like to see the protests continue for the sake of the protest because of the cause, et cetera, solidarity with the players. But I promise you, not a single one of those owners wants to have to deal with this anymore. They don't want to have to answer to the fans who are saying, I'm never going to watch your team again. I'm not buying your tickets anymore. In fact, I'm burning the tickets I do have. I'm not coming to your games. They don't want to have to deal with this anymore. But then if they say, hey, guys, the fans are burning our tickets, stand up. They don't want to have to deal with their players saying, what, you're going to take away my freedom of expression? How dare you? So I promise you all 32 owners are probably listening to the language presented here by Roger Goodell and saying, yeah, let's get that done. Goodell made it clear in the letter, quoting ESPN here. Goodell made it clear in the letter obtained by Adam Schefter that he wants players to stand during the anthem, did not provide specifics on how he intends to ensure it. In other words, he hasn't talked about punitive measures yet. But he wrote that it would include such elements as an in-season platform to promote the work of players on these core issues. The issue discussed and likely acted upon will be during the fall meetings, regularly scheduled fall meetings, October 17th and 18th. Wow, that's coming up next week. Didn't realize how fast that was coming, Kush. A week from today, in fact. In the letter, Goodell said he wanted to end the controversy by agreeing on a uniform approach for all teams. Quote, like many of our fans, we believe that everyone should stand for the national anthem. Really? Really, Raj? You believe that, do you? Then why haven't you been saying that since last year? Why are you playing games here? Why are you trying to tell us that you believe in that? We as a league believe in that now. Everybody should do this. But you didn't say squat about Colin Kaepernick. You didn't say squat about Bennett or Lynch. In fact, you said it's their right to do this. It's their right to express their political views on the clock, on the job. Paying fans coming not to see political statements or expressions, but to see football statements and expressions. Don't like it. And you said tough. Now the fans are responding with their dollars, and suddenly it's, like many of our fans, we believe that everyone should stand for the national anthem. No, too late. We're not buying that. It is good that you're trying to address this, but don't try to make it sound like you were for standing all along. Uh-uh. Not happening. He goes on to say in the letter, it is an important moment in our game. We want to honor our flag and our country, and our fans expect that of us. Now he goes on to say, we also care deeply about our players and respect their opinions and concerns about critical social issues. The controversy over the anthem is a barrier to having an honest conversation and making real progress on the underlying issues. We need to move past this controversy, and we want to do that with our players. All right. Number one, you're right about wanting to move past it or needing to move past it. You're right. You do have to move past it. But the idea that you should be in any way, shape, or form trying to look for platforms to provide your players with those opportunities is part of the problem. That is not the job of the National Football League. You are not a 501(c) political action committee. It's not your job to do that. It's not the team's jobs. It's not the owner's jobs. It's not the player's jobs. In my estimation, if Terry Johnson, and I really don't think there is a Terry Johnson in the NFL, but it's a plain enough name, there might be. I'm using it generically. If a person, a player named Terry Johnson, really has political beliefs and things that he wants to address about the state of some social condition in this country or another, it is perfectly acceptable for him to contact a city, and say, I would like to reserve the public square in that city, the downtown square, the whatever you want to call, the main gathering area, for a Saturday afternoon at 1 o'clock on a, in the off season, and announce that I want to speak on social issues that I have a problem with. Or if he wants, he can contact a venue owner. He can contact a theater owner. He can contact an arena or stadium owner and say, I want to book this. I expect thousands to come and hear me pontificate on what I think is right and wrong with this country, with its police force, with its military, with race in the country, all of this. And I want to see how many people go out there to see him. These players are using their status as football players to hold a captive audience for their political leanings and pontifications. You get 65,000 people in a stadium who have already bought their tickets, and they're thinking, yeah, I've got them now. They can't go anywhere. All they've got, they have to watch or listen to my expression now. And that's exactly what Roger Goodell is finally saying. We kind of have to stop. We cannot allow the players to use this as a platform, especially during the national anthem, because of the incredible disrespect that it shows for the country and those who defend it. I want to see Terry Johnson, rather than taking a knee while the anthem is played, I want to see Terry Johnson rent out or lease out or reserve free of charge in a given city that public square space and say, I'm going to talk politics out here. I might kneel during the national anthem. I'm not sure yet. I might have an anthem. I might not. But I'm going to talk about what I see wrong. Let's see how many people gather. You know what my guesstimation is, Jim? It's going to be a few less than 66,000 that were in that stadium. And that's exactly what their problem is. They know full well that nobody wants to hear them. They won't go out of their way to come and hear them in a given speech or a given statement or a given production. They know nobody's coming. Even if the tickets are free, hell, they could pay people, and you're still not going to get more than a couple dozen people. They know nobody wants to hear it, so they're thinking, okay, we're going to make you have to hear it while you're at the football game. Now, as Adam Schefter said in that piece that I played, the NFL's current anthem policy states that players should stand for the anthem, but it does stop short of requiring it. The proposed new policy is the result of many discussions with clubs and players, according to the commissioner. And they want to change the word should to must. Players must stand. Then the question becomes, what if someone defies the order? And that, of course, is a matter of punitive measures. Will it be a fine? Will it be a suspension? Will it be a slap on the wrist? Will it be progressive? Week one, you do this, it's a slap on the wrist. Week two, it's a threat. Excuse me, week three, it's a $500 fine. Week four, it's a bigger fine. Week five, how are they going to do that? Part of me says, Kush, that I don't think they're going to be able to hash that out in the October 17th, 18th meetings, because I think it's going to have to come down to the collective bargaining agreement. And that bargaining agreement is in place until, oh, darn it, I don't have it in front of me now. I can't remember exactly where they are on the collective, but I want to say 2021. I feel like the NFL's collective bargaining agreement that they have right now is in place until 2021. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, I think so. I'm actually checking right now to make sure on that. Expires after 2020.
Okay, there you go.
So that was close.
So 2021, the season, 2021 season, there will have to be a new one in place unless there's a work stoppage, obviously. So I think that's the time, because I don't think the union is going to allow the owners, when they meet on October 17th and 18th, to just dictate the punitive measures. Here's the punishment for the first offense, second offense, so on and so forth. They're going to have to agree to that, just as they have to agree to all of the disciplinary measures, meted out by the league, by Commissioner Goodell, et cetera, with their own lawyers, essentially giving the league the permission to handle those disciplinary measures, personal conduct policies, and more. So that's kind of where we are. President Trump, as you know, called on owners to fire players. They're not going to do that, and probably shouldn't, unless it gets to be egregious. You know, as I said this yesterday, and I don't want to beat this horse. If I did say it, I apologize for the repetition. But if you didn't hear it yesterday, you should. You know, if you go to a deli and order some pastrami, and dude, while he's slicing your pastrami, is filling your ear with all of his opinions on social matters in America, or matters of politics or candidates, and you're annoyed enough as he's talking to you about this stuff and lecturing you to go to the manager, and if the manager, chances are manager is going to do some kind of a reprimand the first time on the first offense, right? Chances are manager is going to say, you know what, stop harassing our employees. They came here for meat and cheese, not for your political views. Chances are the first offense, that's what would happen. But if the next time you come back, or if a different person goes there and orders themselves a little bit of Gouda and maybe some roast beef, and while they're waiting for their orders to be filled, again, this individual starts with the politicking, chances are the manager is going to say, I told you once, now I told you a second time, you're fired. Your job is to slice meat, ask them how much, ask them how thick they want it cut, put it on the damn scale, bag it, and get it out. Not to harass them with politics. Owners of businesses are indeed allowed to fire people for not following their rules. And if that means making customers uncomfortable with political statements, they will fire them for making customers uncomfortable with political statements. Well, if the deli owner can do that or manager can do that, then guess what? So can the NFL owner. And I think that's ultimately what Donald Trump was trying to say when he said fire these people. Now, the owners might not fire, but they certainly want an opportunity, and Jerry Jones has laid it out to punish, to use punitive measures to get them to come along here and go along with this so that they don't have to deal with these headaches anymore. And I think it is the right approach. I really, really do. It's a little late. Roger Goodell, and you're not going to sell me that you felt this way all along, because now you start to see the dollars being put at risk, dollars drying up. You're not going to sell me on that, but it is the right step at this moment in time, because something has to be done to get this garbage stopped. All right. Since we are talking football, in a manner of speaking, even though we're talking about political footballs, let's talk about real footballs and where to watch it. That's right. If you are looking for your college and professional football fix, there's only one way to go. That's B-Dubs, Buffalo Wild Wings, because they have gone above and beyond for this entire season. Countless taps and HD screens available at all of the B-Dubs locations. And now the entire place is committed to creating the perfect man cave atmosphere for your football fix. Food and drinks included. Don't forget to try the classic menu item, 35th Weck Sandwich. And also, make sure you try the Blue Moon Barbecue Sauce. I don't care if you're dipping tenders in it, or if you're putting it on a burger, or whatever your use is. Wings, get the Blue Moon Barbecue Sauce. You're going to love that. There's a lot more, but you have to come in and find out what it is to the place with the best football experience going. That would be Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports. Please drink responsibly. All right, it's 4:35. Going to get a timeout here. We got a bottom of the hour Sports Center coming, but I promised you something before the bottom of the hour Sports Center, did I not? I told you that Mike Jinks, the head coach of the Bowling Green State University Falcons, is coming along here in just a few minutes to talk about his team's first win of the season. 37-29, they took down Miami on the road at Oxford. Now they've got the Bobcats of Ohio coming up to the Doit on Saturday. And what I've got here that I promised you is a pair of tickets. If you want to go see BG and OU at the Doit on Saturday, be caller number, let's make it a little tougher, caller 9. Call it tougher on Cushland. Caller 9, because he's got to answer him. To 866-240-1065. 866-240-1065. We'll set you up with tickets for OU and at BG at the Doit coming up this Saturday. And then, as I said, after the bottom of the hour local sports center, we're going to have for you head coach Mike Jinks talking about that first win and talking about the challenge of the Bobcats coming up as we continue. Don't forget, we take you until 5 o'clock, so that by my count, that leaves us with 23 minutes of outstanding awesome left. Then we'll turn it over to the awesome stylings of Mike Miller of Mike Miller and Drive Time. So all of that coming up right here on the ticket.
And welcome back into the extravaganza. Jim Cushlin here. Time to shift gears, talk a little college football. The Bowling Green Falcons getting their first win of the season this past Saturday, 37-29, an exciting back and forth game on the road in Oxford. So one win, MAC play, and on the overall season now for the Bowling Green Falcons. And to help us dissect it all and go forward with what's next for the Falcons, we once again welcome in the head coach of the Bowling Green Falcons, Mike Jinks, to the program. Hi, coach. How you doing today?
Doing well, Jim. Thanks for having me.
No, thank you so much for being here. And finally, you and I get to talk about a Bowling Green Falcons win, 37-29 down in Oxford. Fun, interesting back and forth road game. Talk to me about how your guys persevered through this one, because there were two separate times, one going into half, one in the third quarter. You guys needed some late things as well to come back, but just the nature of a back and forth game. Talk to me about how your kids were handling that.
Well, you know, I thought they showed a little bit of resiliency last week in the ability to come back and not only tie but take the lead versus Akron, and then they struck again and took the lead back, and we made the critical mistake in the fourth quarter, and the game got away from us. This week, similar game. They got up to a 13-3 lead. We stayed in the fight. We made some changes. We took the lead right before half, 17-16. They took it back 19-17, and from that point, we kind of exchanged blows until late in the fourth quarter, and we were holding on to a 30-29 lead. And at that point, what you've done is by staying in the game for 58 minutes and 37 seconds, you allow yourself to take advantage of a break, for lack of a better word. The guy hit the ball, hit their, you know, one of their up back's legs, and our kids were playing hard and to the whistle like they've done for us all year long, and were able to scoop and score and make a play for us. Proud of the kids' effort, proud of the way they went out and gave themselves an opportunity to win a big conference game, because, as we all know, Miami is one of the teams that was kind of picked to win the East. So to go to their place and win it in that fashion is a heck of an accomplishment for our football team.
And I love the word you used there a couple of minutes ago, Coach, resilient. That's kind of how I look at your guys, you know, in this one. You know, given the times that Miami came back to put scores on the board after you guys did, could have been easy for them to just tuck and run, if you will, but they did not. They persevered. They showed resiliency, forced the turnover, the big turnover at the end to seal it. Talk to me about that, if you would.
Again, Jim, it's about giving yourself an opportunity to win a game. And then we've talked to the kids all year long about, you know, trying to, they got to shut out the outside noise. You got a lot of people, a lot of opinions about a lot of different things. The bottom line is, you look at our conference and you look at the Miamis of the world and the Ohio's of the world, you know, everybody's played a tough schedule, a non-conference. Look at Western Michigan, everybody's 1-3 or at the best 2-2 coming into this thing. You know, that's just part of our conference and part of what we do. You got to shut everything out and understand that in this conference right now, at this time, there is great parity, and that on any week, anybody can win. A couple years back, it was us. You know, we had the NFL guys. We had the guys that were just different makers, and they got one-on-one. They were winning on a consistent basis. Then Toledo with the Kareem Hunt and then the big tight end of the world, you know, they came in and they had the difference makers. And then last year was Western Michigan, you know, with their receiver going in the first round, the offensive lineman going in the third round. They had those guys. Right now in the league, those guys are spread out a little bit, and there's great parity, and any week you can win. And we knew that coming into the season. We understood that, and it was just a matter of staying together, not listening what the outside world has to say, and really managing that non-conference schedule to where you're halfway healthy in order to go and compete and give yourself a chance to win in conference play.
Yeah, that's such a good point, Coach, to remind everybody of the parity of this league. When teams match up against each other, who knows what could happen on that any given Saturday. So for those who had forgotten, yeah, certainly this game, prime example of that. We're talking with head coach Mike Jinks of the Bowling Green Falcons after a 37-29 win back on Saturday in Oxford against Miami. First win, not just the conference play, but overall for the Falcons on the season. Offensively, Coach, you got some big-time production out of the running game, over 200 yards total. You got it from the senior, and you got it from the freshman.
Yeah, those guys all complimented each other. Both seniors actually played well. Lost Josh early in the third quarter, and then that gave Andrew Kerr opportunity to get more touches, and, you know, boy, did he explode on the scene, kind of like we knew he would. He had shown glimpses early, especially versus Michigan State, and then been battling some hamstrings. He's about healthy now, and then later in that game, was really proud of Donovan Wilson, who came in and almost closed that game out for us. So, you know, proud of the backs and the way they ran, but it all starts up front, and our offensive line, you know, was able to get some movement and open some holes, and those guys took advantage of it.
Talk to me about James Morgan's effort, 11-25, 222, three touchdowns, did have the one interception. You had mentioned to me when we talked last week that it was going to be Morgan due to the injury at the time. First of all, how's Dodger healing up? And secondly, does this change the dynamics at the quarterback position? Because I thought that was a solid outing by Morgan.
Definitely a solid outing. He gave us a chance to win. You know, he had the one turnover, but that ball was a ball that he lightning that Miami had been throwing all day long, and the receivers were making plays of 50-50 balls, or if they couldn't catch the ball, they were coming back and becoming a defender. Jared Wise is going to be a good player for us, another one of those freshmen that are playing, kind of just drifted away from the ball and caused the ball to get intercepted. So I thought he did the little things. He gave us a chance to win. I'd like to see his completion percentage be a little bit better, but I was proud of his effort, and when we needed touchdowns, he kept the ball in play, and he hit the explosive play. So he played well. We'll continue to evaluate that position. What I'll tell you on Daigie is that, the kid's still 18 years old, and we won't put him out there until he's fully healthy. He's got a ton of football left ahead of him.
And talk to me about his favorite receiver on this day, the senior T.O. Redding, nearly 200 yards through the air, 197 to be exact, just 8 catches, 2 of them into the end zone for 6. Solid outing from him.
Well, you kind of saw it coming. Every week he's kind of been showing, becoming more and more confident, and anything thrown his way, he's been coming down with. So, and really, it was something that we talked about to all the quarterbacks, not just James, about keeping the ball in play and giving these guys to make a catch and a play on the run. We felt like we've got some guys on the outside and inside in the slot that, given the opportunity, they can be as explosive as anybody in the league, and I think T.O. proved that Saturday.
We're talking with head coach Mike Jinks of the Bowling Green Falcons here on the Extravaganza. 37-29 winners over Miami on the road in Oxford. Come back to the Doit this Saturday, do you, coach? But it's going to be a tough one. The other team that a lot of people had as the possible East champion, the Ohio Bobcats, coming in. That's a 2:30 pregame, 3:30 kickoff from the Doit this Saturday. Talk to me about what the Bobcats can do. They're a tough, tough team.
No doubt. You know, half of them got Miami picked, the other half got Ohio picked. Coach Solich has been around for a while and got great respect for him. And you know one thing, when his team rolls in here, they're going to be prepared both physically and mentally. They're not going to beat themselves. They're going to be sound, and they're going to make you stop them. So we're going to have to match their physicality first and foremost on the offensive and defensive lines, and then we're going to have to play smart football. I know. I really feel like from an effort standpoint, we're playing the game the right way. We're running around. We're flying around. I really think from a physicality standpoint, I like the way that we're playing football. We can still make better decisions throughout 60 minutes of a ball game. So those are some things that we're going to have to do in order to come out with a victory on Saturday. But, again, like I stated before, we match up well. We match up well. It's the little things that we're going to have to be on top of. And then we are playing a lot of young kids, and they're kind of senior-heavy teams, especially on defense. It's time to grow up. It's time to make plays. Kind of challenged those guys to do that last week. I think I've been on the coaching staff, a ton over the last 5 weeks and holding them extremely accountable about putting these kids in the positions to make plays. I think they've done a great job of that, especially here in conference play, of knowing who we are and what our kids are capable of doing. Now they got to go make plays, period. And they did that the other day.
Well said, Coach. It's the Bowling Green Falcons looking for win number 2, conference and overall, this Saturday at the Doit against the Ohio Bobcats. 2:30 coverage time over on Talk Radio 100.7, the 3:30 kickoff. Coach, best of luck out there. Hope it's a fun atmosphere. Everybody come on out to pack the Doit, and hopefully we're talking about win number 2 in a row when we reconvene next week, Coach.
82 degrees, both teams fighting for a chance to win the East. Can't get any better than that, and we got them at home. All right, so hope to see everybody out there. Thanks, Jim.
That is head coach of the Bowling Green Falcons, Mike Jinks, joining us here on The Ticket. And, last week really showing the parity of this league again, not just the Bowling Green getting a win. Miami wasn't the favorite the way Ohio was in that Eastern Division, but there were a couple people who picked them to finish in the upper tier of the standings over there. But here's the explanations of what I mean by parity. Toledo Rockets and all their power, they only beat Eastern Michigan, who's a recovering program, 20-15. Ohio, those East favorites, they're one game below where Bowling Green is in the conference today because they lost at home to Central Michigan. And then, of course, a 7 overtime game, 71-68 Western winning at Buffalo. Those are just 3-4 games right off the top of my head that I could just look at just from last week and say, yes, when we talk about the Mid-American Conference having parity, this is exactly what we're talking about. And Ohio's a solid team. You know, Frank Solich has been there now for a MAC coach, especially seemingly forever. So he knows what he wants to do. But as you heard Coach Jinks, Bowling Green, despite their struggles that we've seen, match up well with the Bobcats. It's going to be about getting a good start early. Because, I mean, this is a Bobcats team. You know, they beat Central Michigan. at or lose to Central Michigan, I should say, at home. And then they beat, yeah, I know it's Kansas, but that's still technically a power team. They go out and they beat Kansas in the opening week of overall college football way back in early September. So this is indeed one of those situations where you do have a lot of parity in this league. So maybe that's the first step for the Bowling Green Falcons to get themselves back into this. We saw it last year, as I mentioned a bunch of times in these segments, staring 1-11 at the face. They won 3 in a row to finish a more respectable 4-8. And that's part of what parity in this wonderful conference, the Mid-American Conference, is able to do. I know it's not the top echelon conference, not even technically a power conference, but, you know, any team in this conference, when you get into conference play, seemingly any team can win on essentially any given Saturday. And that's going to do it for this edition of the Extravaganza. Thanks so much for hanging out with us today. Stick around. Drive time. Mike Miller coming at you next. Speaking of Bowling Green, we're going to have the opener of Bowling Green Hockey later tonight. Yes, you heard me right. Bowling Green Hockey back with us here in Cumulus Toledo over in our sister station, Talk Radio 100.7. They're at Western Michigan tonight. And that is a 6:35 coverage time over at Talk Radio 100.7. Major League Baseball playoffs continue as well here on 106.5 The Ticket. So a lot of fun stuff coming at you later tonight, but stick around. Drive time coming at you next. We'll reconvene for a fun extravaganza on your Wednesday tomorrow. See ya.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.